This week, we're talking about Driver's latest fight against Big Brother and a confusing development on tariffs for JDM imports, plus an interview with Haggerty CEO McKeel Haggerty from last week's Aaron Water show. But first, the truck that broke Instagram. Welcome to the Big Three. Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Big Three, the only car news show you need to listen to. My name is Nolan Sykes. Joining me, as always, on the couch, it's Joe Weber.
Hit me with that wah wah. I was just going to get meatball subs.
And Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome.
I love those meatball subs.
Have you tried them? Yeah, they're all right.
How you guys doing?
Good, man. Good. How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm all right.
I've got some news.
You've got some news, Joe.
I went to a Tuvan Throat singing concert last week.
Okay.
And it was crazy as hell. It wasn't what
Explain
I thought it was.
If people don't know what Tuvan Throat singing is, will you?
Tuva is a region in Mongolia, and they can open up their throats like didgeridoos, and there's a tone they create with their throat, and then they can split their vocal cords and create overtones on top of that. And do up to 3 overtones. So they basically are singing like a whole chord with their
Whoa.
Mouth.
That's human made. That's
one person doing that.
You're the different tone.
That's unbelievable. Wow.
The human throat.
I can't do that. There's no way.
So I was expecting like that.
Yeah.
And maybe even there's like some.
Was it like
some of
death
them
metal?
Some of them have crossed into like pop almost where there's like cellos and there's like multiple people doing it at the same time. I was like, oh, this
like
is going to
yellow
be sick.
Card.
Yeah. It was a white hippie dude from Seattle that named himself Arrington D. Dionysus. And we looked him up afterwards. He's like somehow wrapped up in Pizzagate. And we're like, oh, this dude scammed us. Because the first thing he does is put a trash can on his head and start yelling.
Wait.
And we're like, this is insane. What?
Was it not throat singing?
He did. Like, he did. So we were like, this is a scam. What did we sign up for? He takes the trash can off and he picks up a coffee can and starts yelling in it. And then we're like, we got to get out of here.
How did you get?
So then we're like, all right, we're about to leave. He picks up, what I thought was like a baritone sax, but was like a bass clarinet.
Okay.
And we're like, okay, maybe he's going to do something cool.
Stupid idiot. You thought that was a baritone sax.
He picks up this bass oboe or bass clarinet. And we're like, okay, maybe it might get cool. And he sticks his head in the bell of it and he starts yelling. And we're like, this is a scam, dude. This is crazy.
How much did you pay to go see this?
It was
concert?
Like 19 bucks. It wasn't a big deal.
How'd you hear about it?
Yeah.
Someone sent it to me as a joke because we used to listen to throat singing for our board game nights when we were playing like Settlers of Catan to like
B-O-R-E-D.
Yeah,
game.
Okay, you get like the ambiance.
Get into the board
really
games.
Sets the mood.
Yeah.
No, I could see that.
That's
yeah, so we ended up staying for the whole time because we were like, maybe it's going to get cool now. and then he did a Q&A at the end. And
you were just like, what was that?
He did do one cool thing for like 2 minutes and then it was like throat singing through the clarinet. And it was like, bah, bah, bah. It was like so sick sounding, but he only did it for 2 minutes out of the whole hour and a half.
Hour and a half.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But in his Q&A, it just didn't add up. Cause he was like, we're very coming into this. We bring our own spirits, but we're also wary of the spirits that are in LA.
Interesting.
And then people were like later on in the Q&A, he was like, they're like, so do you channel the spirits when you're doing the throat singing? He's like, nah, I don't really think about that.
why did he have why do you have a Q&A?
I've never, yeah. Sounds like a very interesting show.
Yeah. It was the most LA thing I've ever done, and I'm glad that I did it because it's, you know, me and Dave and Waylon went to it, and Deuce. Deuce went to it.
Oh, really?
Deuce, Deuce loves a weird show.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Should we get in some car news?
Let's do car news.
Yeah. All right. Please cut that down, too.
I don't know if there's anything you could cut.
If Lego made a real car, it would probably look a lot like what new automaker Slate has been cooking up. The new Jeff Bezos-backed manufacturer just debuted their first vehicle, the Slate truck.
It's been blowing up the internet since. It looks cool.
It is. What's nice about it is it looks like a truck.
Yeah.
It does.
Right?
It does. Yeah. Get some credit for that. Yeah.
I don't think I've seen a lot of negative feedback on it. And I can't remember the first time that
about to bring something. No, I'm kidding. But anyway, here is the truck right here. It is a little guy, a little boxy guy called the Slate. It comes in two flavors. You get the truck, and then you can add on a roof section on the back to make a 5-passenger SUV.
It comes like in multiple flavors, yeah. Nolan.
Well, no, this is the truck is the only vehicle that they build. And then you can buy components like the roof to put on the back to make it an SUV.
Like the first gen 4Runner.
Yes, indeed. And there's also like a fastback SUV back, which has a more kind of like aerodynamic look to it.
There's also one that's just brushed steel, and it kind of looks like a wedge.
Yeah. Yeah, it costs $120,000. No, so this is the only truck that only comes in that gray color. If you want to change the color at all, you do have to get it wrapped, which they will supply.
They will do it.
Either you can do that on your own, or they have... you know, one of the big features that they talked a lot about in their reveal was the fact that these pre-cut wraps are available to get for your truck, and then you can apply it yourself. Although I would probably do that through a shop because wrapping is very hard. The truck is an EV, but the two things everyone is talking about are the price tag and the truck's seemingly endless customization options. Slate starts at $27,500, well under the average new car price of $48,000, something they repeated many, many times throughout the reveal. Yeah. The truck starts as a bare-bones utilitarian platform that can be customized with nearly 100 optional accessories, including typical truck mods like 32-inch tires and gear racks. Pretty cool stuff. But the truck can even be converted into an almost entirely different vehicle with optional add-ons like open-air rear seating, or you can get a fully enclosed SUV conversion. Guys, what do you think of the Slate truck?
I think it's pretty cool. I like that they're making something that's we've talked about all the time. Where it's what happened to just
make
the bare bones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I like that about it. I am a little bit leery of the fact that it's bare bones is $27,000. Mm-hmm. You get your whatever incentives may or may not exist where you are, and maybe you can get it under $20,000. That's great. Mm-hmm. But then the fact that that's the bare bones, and then there's so many other options, like the bare bones ones goes 150 miles.
Yes.
Do you want a bigger battery? That's going to cost you. And I fear that it's very much akin to perhaps a Pizza Hut 2-for-1 medium deal. And then you start adding the toppings and you're like, holy shit, how did I get to 2 pizzas for $40?
Yes.
Yeah. So
what even is a service charge at a pizza place where I pick up the pizza? Yeah.
That's why you got to go Domino's. Domino's still has the 2 for $7 or something.
No, but that turns into $36 very quickly. Somehow.
Yeah, it's all the specialty pizzas and the toppings.
But you're right. Yeah. With 100 different customizations that they're talking about or modules, I do wonder what the pricing is going to be on a lot of those. Are they completely proprietary? Are they only available through Slate? Oh, yeah. Or will you be able to get aftermarket customizations? Hopefully so, that don't mess with the functionality of the truck software or anything like that.
I think it's cool that there's just an option to get this bare bones one because a lot of people are going to get that one. And that's the price of base Impreza or like a Sentra or something.
Yeah.
And it's also very like it's already a truck, so you can you can work in it. You can have a commuter vehicle if you want.
And, only real drive.
And you're not stuck with a bad infotainment center. Like the base one has roll up windows. It doesn't have a stereo.
Hand crank windows.
Yeah. And if you want to max it out for any reason, it's like getting a maxed out Sentra for. Who would do that?
I actually own a very basic truck with hand crank windows and manual locks, much like the Slate. And I will tell you that the hand crank does get very annoying after a while, as well as manual locks.
I've noticed, though, your forearms are really starting to get come in.
Yeah. So I am curious how many people would actually buy this and keep it completely basic. We are, I think, so used to those features. I mean, dude, power windows, that's been a thing, a normal thing. Mm-hmm. It's probably like what, like 85?
Sure.
At least. So how much is it going to cost to put those power windows in if you wanted to? You know?
I want
to
see what the top maxed out price is.
We don't know yet.
We don't know.
We just know what they're.
Yeah. Dual motor? It's only single motor.
They say they do not yet have plans for a dual motor. Right now, it's just rear-wheel drive.
This is what I thought the Lightning was going to be. I thought the Lightning was going to be the Model T of EVs. Mm-hmm. And I think this is like the closest you can get to the Model T of EVs.
Because it's only being built in that one configuration, the very basic truck. Where you
get it
but then the customer has to pay for all the other options and install them either themselves or have it installed by Slate.
So you only get
even that an SUV for $3,200.
Yeah, not bad. But how much is it going to cost to have that installed by Slate? Because, you know, if you don't install it correctly, you know, one, that's a safety hazard. And two, apparently there are sensors on the truck that won't let you drive it if it detects that it's not been installed correctly, which I think is smart, obviously. You can't just
That's a liability for them.
That big liability, but
so it's almost like the Model T if Spirit Airlines made the Model T.
I
do want to know how comfortable it is.
Because
it does have there are configurators that you can make it like an off-roader, or you can make it like a lowered mini truck if you want to, which I think is sick.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And I really like how they marketed it too. They put these wraps on, like business wraps on it, and kind of just put them out in the open. They're just like fake businesses. There's like a taxidermy one. There's like, this is the marketing angle. And I think that's really clever of them to just like, almost like how Beyonce drops an album and doesn't hint at it or whatever. It's just like there.
But it also, this exists. You know what I mean? Once you get in somebody's brain like that, and I think it underscores the design of it, I think is very intentional to look like the trucks we all grew up with.
Yeah, I think it's about the same size. I mean, on their website, they have like different shape, size comparisons of different trucks, like F-150, Tacoma, and then like the one that it is the size of is like a Nissan Hardbody from the 80s, right? Yeah. So that's pretty cool, harkening back. I guess I'm just cautiously optimistic about this. You know, like I said, like, the fact that everything is so, you can just buy this. Oh, you're missing an option. Just conveniently, we have it for purchase that you can buy this little module. We've seen how that affects other industries and particularly tech with, you know, Apple, of course, you know, charging $200 for more RAM on your computer or whatever like that. And you can't install it yourself either. I don't know. I think the base price is very exciting, but I'm just kind of wary of everything else surrounding this.
It is appealing to a lot more people that aren't, I wouldn't call car people. I got so many DMs from people that are in, you know, I did comedy with or, you know, are not in this industry that were like, oh, have you seen this yet? Like, I think it's exciting to a lot of people who don't really know much about cars in general. And I think that's cool. As far as like a utilitarian truck, it's a little confusing because the payload is like 1,400 pounds max. The towing capacity is only 1,000 pounds, which is like whatever.
But again, that's all the base.
That's the base. But the bed, like it's 2 feet shorter than a Maverick, but has a bigger bed than the Maverick. So I think you're going to see a lot of videos of people like bottoming these things out and, you know, like maybe overheating the motor or something.
I mean, smaller businesses like landscapers or... I don't know, just machine shops even, I think.
Flower businesses.
Stuff like that. I think this definitely could appeal to that, especially in cities like LA where...
down pillows.
Pringles. Windows.
Sure, window.
Yeah. Windows. Pella. Shout out to Shenandoah, Iowa. Pella Factory.
Pella Windows,
What would you guys get it wrapped in? What would be your perfect Slate truck?
Well, they showed off a couple of variations. You mentioned like the lowered street truck is really cool, but I also like the like open air kind of version where you take the doors off and have like the roll hoop in the back with just a roof but no sides on it. I think that'd be really fun here in LA, you know, with the good weather we have.
I think I'd do like a mini Rivian SUV, fully enclosed, definitely the back seats for the babe. Then you could put your, I don't know, you're going to pick up art. You're not worried about people stealing it out of your bed.
Pick up, I like art?
You're going to pick up,
you know,
the last,
you
painting
know,
that
Arthur
you
McAllister.
Thomas
Joe gives rides all the time.
The range for the base model is only 150 miles, similar to the Nissan Leaf when it first came out. Slate advertises the prices as, quote, as low as $20,000, but this is assuming that federal EV incentives are applied with this new administration that's still up in the air. That being said, that might be an advantage of having Jeff Bezos on board. If there's some sort of commotion about taking away this incentive, Jeff Bezos can put his finger on the scale and be like, hey, actually.
We're already trying. Everybody in the industry is already trying.
Yeah, I know.
Remember, Tesla mentioned, Musk mentioned tariffs at his earnings call. He kind of was like,
it all comes back to the price. This is going to make EVs more affordable for the common man. And the way they do that is just make it as bare bones as possible, which is what we've been asking for. As car people, just give us a basic car.
It's easier for a startup to do these things, to make their own production in a way that can make a cheap car. Whereas if you're a larger manufacturer, you've already have all of the way you do things, you know, and to undo that may even make your cheap car more expensive. You know what I'm saying? So I think it is exciting that they're thinking about their priorities. How do we make a basic car?
That is something they mentioned in the reveal. You know, they don't have a paint shop in their factory, so they don't have to factor that into costs. And as a result, the cars are not painted. They have like a composite. They have composite body panels, fender panels, and all that stuff. It's like a plastic or whatever that does not get painted at all. You know, so it's just, you got to get that wrap on there. You know, they're talking about if you get a fender bender, you can replace your fender easily.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
It is interesting.
That's another thing I didn't think of is it easy to fix yourself?
Well, we don't know that yet, though. That's what I'm saying about being cautiously optimistic is like we're getting the pitch here, and it's like they talk about customization, they talk about doing all that stuff, but still like, okay, but you're still a startup car manufacturer backed by some very big players who are interested in making a lot of money. So that's why I'm like, it's not like this is coming out of nowhere. And it's like you and me making a car for the people that we would be interested in that kind of stuff. I don't know. I'm just like, let's, like everything else, I think, temper our expectations and just see where it goes and then assess again when we know the facts rather than.
Yeah, it's got a lot of hype.
What would that car company would be called? Jolin.
Jolin.
Jolin?
Yeah. It would probably suck. The car would suck.
Not gonna lie, that car would suck.
It would suck. You're like, wait a minute, this looks like a 90s Taurus that you guys has refurbished.
It's like it a would just cyberpunk have a Taurus. Why does it have a top hat holder? Come with goggles?
Why is there so much copper tubing inside there?
it's all steampunk. That's the steampunk Celica.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Like the tariffs on just about everything else, tariffs on JDM imports were on, then off, then on again. And last we heard, cars 25 years old and older were exempt. But recently, a nameless friend of the show.
Well, he has a name, but we're not going to use it.
Yes, an anonymous friend of the show.
Yeah, we're not going to name Jimmy at all.
Got hit with a surprise. The person we're talking about bought a non-GTR R34 Skyline for $35,000 a few months back. It left Japan on March 28th, around the beginning of the second tariff wave. When it got to the U.S. on April 17th, the buyer discovered it had a total tariff charge of $13,289. This is a 37.5% charge, which came from adding individual 25%, 10%.
We're not sure. He's not sure why this charge is. He's looking into it.
Okay. But it came from adding up an individual 25%, 10%, and 2.5% tariffs altogether.
That adds up. 37.5%. So.
And he was like, but wait a minute. I thought, so before all this, the tariff on these cars were 2.5%. And then it was announced it was 25%. All right. But now that it's coming in, the tariff is back down to 10%. So this person's like, what in the heck is going on here? Because he was under the impression. It's like, 10%, I can handle that. 37.5?
Too much.
Yeah.
So the person that works at Donut that may or may not be Jimmy is friends with this guy. And this is all kind of hearsay. But he shared the import slip.
Yeah.
It all adds up to 37.5%, which means that instead of like going up or going down from 25 to 10, it was all just added, which is crazy.
That is crazy. And definitely.
He's still figuring it out.
Yeah, but the slip exists.
Yeah, the slip. Yeah. I'm saying the slip exists. But if you go to the register and they're like, oh, here's your wrong total, you say, wait a minute, this is the right total, and then they figure it out with you.
So all this is definitely disheartening.
Well, you wouldn't expect a tariff on a used car. It's 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It's doesn't have a competitor in the U.S., right? Like, it's not like the whole point of these tariffs is to, like, incentivize people to buy new cars from American manufacturers. And this is clearly a collector buying a very niche car. Who honestly probably already has new cars that he bought that were manufactured in some way here in the U.S., right? Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, sure. This doesn't, I mean, the tariffs themselves don't make sense, but also this doesn't make sense that it all just got added up.
No, that definitely not.
It's just chess. It's peacocking from the administration to be like, look, we have control over this, when really it comes down to American consumers. And the fact that he's saying that it's supposed to bring manufacturing back into the U.S. is all a farce, because
Nissan's finally going to build another factory here to build those R34s again.
Yeah. And it's also something that takes so long that, like, not even going to happen in this administration. It's, if it spurs manufacturers to come back into the U.S., it'll be a 10-year process before they're up and running.
Yeah. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just peacocking.
So he's putting on a big fluffy top hat.
Well, then he should buy
your car. He's
putting
on his goggles. He's putting on his top hat, and he's blown steam up all of our asses.
In GM's ongoing legal battle over its selling of driver data, the company has a new argument. Your data isn't private if the roads are public. So we covered this a few months ago on the show, but for those of you who don't know what's going on, General Motors is currently in the middle of a major lawsuit for collecting and selling data on drivers of GM vehicles. Not cool.
But I think is interesting is that the argument is, look, if you're in public, you can be surveilled. Like, that's their defense. And so it's like, oh, you're admitting that's what you're doing. That's pretty shitty.
Well, it's moving the goalposts. Every time they get caught doing this stuff, they're like, well, how about this?
Right.
It's bullshit. And it's like, I don't want anyone knowing how much I weigh, especially my car.
Well, there's also been people who've lost insurance or had to have higher premiums from, I don't know if it was GM, it might've been Ford's, but there's little things when you're buying a car and it's like, don't sell my data, then you miss something else. Like,
I hate that it's every website you go to now is like, don't sell my data. I should be able to just click it once on whatever device I'm on. And you should be able to do that with your car as well.
I just don't.
It just doesn't seem right, but it's also we're in an age where it's, what do you expect? And who the hell is going to do anything about it? Because nobody makes laws anymore to protect people.
That's fun. Good outlook.
That's why I got my sovereign citizen license. You don't have to go to the DMV anymore. You can camp out in front of a post office and film people, and they can't do anything about it.
I think that is true, though, too.
That's why I do it.
Citizen. That's the whole thing. It's like, ironically, you don't have an expectation of privacy when you're in public.
But it's but look, the question is, when you're in your car, are you in public?
See, that's the thing.
No, you're in your car. Like,
yeah, you technically are in public, but inside your car, like that.
The car is private. I own my car outright. It's mine.
Yeah.
It's not public.
Yeah.
Look, here's the pink.
It is kind of like a blurring, you know, we see this in gaming a lot, right? You don't really, if you're not buying a physical copy of your game or DVD or any other media, you're usually buying a license
to consume it for a given amount of time before, you know, the rights can go away and immediately you don't have that in your library anymore. We're seeing that kind of seep into real world products like your car, this kind of wibbly wobbly legalese screw you in the end and sell your data so your insurance premiums go
up. It's just wibbly wobbly legalese.
It is,
dude. At the end of the day.
It is.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's not, it's just like, but on that point, like, yeah, your car is in public when you're driving on roads, sure. But like inside, even though, you know, sometimes you might be able to look in someone's window and see them picking their nose, that still counts as public. But, you know, you're in a little enclosed pod. You would expect that to be your private kind of area. You'd expect that to be private. Like when you're in a restaurant in public and someone walks through the door, that's expected.
Yeah.
Right. When you're in your car, if someone walked into your car, opened your door to your car, you would feel
that's
like
assault, brother.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Wouldn't like self-defense kind of like guidelines for your home applying the same way in your car?
Oh, you could argue self-defense if someone opened your door.
You can't karate chop GM's surveillance.
Right. And that's a problem for me.
Yeah.
I would like to.
Well, the difference between the video game analogy and this is like you're buying your car outright. And so you don't have a digital copy of your car.
Right. Well, I do because I have a whole garage of NFTs and they're gaining value by the day.
Nice. Yeah, your Joker Challenger NFT.
You know what I'm talking about.
You spent way too much money on that.
It's one of one, dude.
Did you see that Joker Challenger that I posted? It was a Charger, maybe. It sold at this Barrett Jackson or like Mecum. I can't remember what auction it was, but it was like $9,000. Like a pristine Joker wrapped.
I don't think it was a wrap.
It was paint, right?
I think so. Okay. Yeah.
Even better. That's like a $10,000 paint job. And it's selling for less than that. Yeah. That's crazy.
So you were about to make a point about.
I think the kick ass deal.
Point is that the Joker belongs on the Challenger and the Charger and no other cars.
Great.
I forgot to eat something this morning. So I might feel like my blood sugar is low.
Yeah. Okay. In short, I think GM's going to get away with this one, dude.
We'll see, man.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
All right, a few of us went to the Air and Water Porsche show over the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Joe, how was that?
Yeah, so I went to the Air and Water Porsche show and auction this weekend. The auction was held by Broad Arrow and Haggerty. And we got exclusive access to interview McKeel Haggerty from Haggerty Insurance.
McKeel Haggerty of Haggerty.
Yeah.
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 Not Haggerty, like he's a
Harry Potter character.
Harry Potter. Haggerty.
Did he start the company?
His parents did. Okay. And they started it as boat insurance in Detroit, or, you know, like Northern Michigan, whatever. And then they expanded into classic car insurance. And let me tell you, there's some cool classic cars there this weekend. I didn't think I was like a speedster guy.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many cool Porsche speedsters. There's a 356 Zagato speedster from like the late 50s that was so sick.
You want to put on your white t-shirt, your jeans, your leather jacket.
Yeah.
Go James Dean mode. Go out for a drive.
Not full James Dean mode, but like maybe like
50%.
Like I work for Dropbox and I'm, you know, have a Thursday. I have a random Thursday off and I'm like leaving the Bay Area to go to that garlic town.
You're going to Gilroy
for the garlic festival.
Yeah. Nice.
And you know, I'm taking the afternoon off.
That's pretty fun.
So I'm putting on my Arc'teryx jacket and I'm hopping in my Zagato speedster and I'm going to smell when I get back because I'm going to this garlic festival.
What a picture you just painted for us. I just saw that whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Back to this Porsche show. It was very, very cool. I saw many a dream car.
Well, we were out there as well too, weren't we?
Yeah. If you guys don't know, we bought a very derelict Porsche that had been in a landslide for $800.
Yes.
We
brought that out.
We brought it out. We got a bunch of people's reactions to it. But that's neither here nor there. We got a really cool interview with McKeel that I'm really excited to show you guys. Let's get into it.
Let's hear it.
Wait for it. Everyone, get their ears ready. McKeel, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. Welcome to California, too, by the way. We have kind of Michigan weather going on right now.
Yeah, thanks. I brought some great weather for you, and it's great to be here. You know, it's my job. Bring the bad weather wherever I go.
It's, for anyone not watching this on YouTube, it's raining pretty hard outside, which is, it's been sunny every single day this month, except for this one day. But yeah, McKeel, welcome.
Yeah.
McKeel is the CEO of Hagerty. If you didn't put that together, McKeel Hagerty, you're the first CEO I've ever interviewed. So please go easy on me.
Don't worry. We got it. You go easy on me and we'll have a good time.
No, gotcha,
we get to talk about the stuff we really like, which is right behind us, I guess.
We are in a hangar right now, an airplane hangar, for the Broad Arrow auction, which is a bunch of Porsches. We are at the Air Water Porsche show in Costa Mesa right now. And specifically, this hangar is the Broad Arrow Porsche auction. There's like millions of dollars worth of very rare Porsches right behind us. You are a Porsche guy.
I am, yeah. From the beginning.
From the beginning. Yes. Tell us about your first car.
Well, I'm pretty lucky. I love asking the first car story. It's like my favorite, like, dinner party topic, because, you know, it makes people smile. I was just very fortunate that my first car was really cool. My dad was a car guy. I was tinkering with cars, restoring cars, but we were kind of more of a Ford family in a way.
Oh, wow.
Until somehow German cars kind of crept into the mix. My older sister restored a 1960 Porsche 356B Roadster with my dad when she was early teenager.
Was this before your Porsche?
Before mine. She was 9 years in front of me, so I was a little boy. And I remember, like, Porsches kind of being tinkered on in the garage, that kind of thing. And so when it was sort of my turn coming along, kind of 11, 12, we started searching, you know, local, you know, just going through classified ads in the newspaper kind of thing. And my dad knew this guy who had a couple of old Porsches out behind his house. And it took us, well, more than a year to convince him to sell them. And so, yeah, sure enough, from right when I turned 13, the guy called and said, hey, I'm ready to sell. Come get the car. And it is a 1967 911S, which, you know, for me at the time, I didn't quite realize it's one of the coolest early 911s you could ever get. And I still have it. And I paid $500 for it.
That's incredible.
Which I like to say is the only really good car deal I've ever made, just because it was so cheap. And, you know, I mowed lawns to pay for parts to restore it. And
you fully restored it?
Yes.
How long before it was up and running?
It took me a couple of years.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, Porsches, especially from that era, and especially if they were left outside, were really rust buckets.
Yeah.
And they just the amount of rust problems to deal with, and plus getting it running again. So it took me a couple of years. And about the time I got my driver's permit, It was roadworthy.
That's great.
And so my first drives, literally, I was 15 with my permit, with my dad sitting in the passenger seat. And, you know, 40 whatever years later, I still have it. And
that's,
I love
amazing.
Porsches. I've always loved Porsches.
And this is what you drove to school?
Well, I did. And there's kind of a funny story about that. I live in northern Michigan, wintry place. Porsches are not good winter cars. So I had an old Ford truck that I would drive to school. But my high school would only give you one permit for your, like windshield. And so when I drive the Porsche in the spring, I'd park it in the teacher's parking lot, because my assumption was they're never going to bust me. Like, they're not going to believe a student has a 911. And I never got in trouble.
That's
so
great.
I was lucky. Yeah.
I think I got a couple toes out of my high school parking lot for
driving something fun, hopefully.
No, just not parking in the right spot.
Oh, well.
But I remember being like a teenager and being like, you're doing this to a teenager?
Yeah.
I don't have any money for this.
Right.
So you mentioned Porsches not being great off-road. What do you feel about this new, I guess, I wouldn't call it a resurgence, but this new bump in off-road 911s, like the Dakar. There's also like the Lamborghini Stirato. How do you feel about this like ultra-luxury jump into off-road?
Well, I love it because, you know, again, I'm a fan of Porsches. I'm a fan of kind of all kind of cool cars, especially sports cars. And I always felt that why does nobody drive them in, you know, bad weather? And why isn't there kind of some version that's not a, not necessarily an SUV. And so I guess, I don't know what the exact category is. Call it these kind of safari cars that the Dakar and the Strato. And then you look at just some of these other kind of cool semi-off-road cars. I love it. And I actually drive, I've driven a newer 911 for years in the winter with snow tires. Love the car. I have a Taycan now, and that
with snow is pretty wild.
It's pretty cool. So I think it's a new category. And I think in a weird way, because, you know, there's so much, we're in Southern California, lots of congestion on the roadways. I think a lot of people are just desiring a way to use a car differently.
I think so, yeah.
And who cares if you take it out on a dirt road or in the rain or in the snow? It's awesome.
I mean, if you got $300,000 to drop on a car, you definitely have $20,000 to fix the paint when you get chips when you're driving, you know, off-road and stuff like that.
Well, or it, you know, the stone chip becomes like a little witness
mark.
A little badge of, you know, you weren't, you know, too much of a, you know, wimp to drive the car. Why not go make it happen?
As an insurer, when you see cars, when you see that guy on Instagram that took his F40 camping and he's driving on gravel and stuff, is that something that kind of makes you...
Yeah, that was a little cringeworthy. Yeah. You know, that one freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think you want to openly damage the cars, but I am a believer in driving them. And in fact, you know, as I professionally got around the car world, not just, you know, my boyhood and, you know, childhood, early adulthood, I loved going to car shows, but now I really like car tours. I love it when,
rallies,
you know, being
like
able
that.
To go on rallies, go on tours. People who really drive their stuff, regardless of the age or the value or whatever. And it's probably the biggest shock that a lot of people have that don't know our world of the cars. And they'll ask me, like, you insure all these really expensive cars. Well, people don't drive them, do they? And I'm like, well, I sure hope they do. I mean, there is nothing more sad than an undriven car.
Yep.
And we're just really passionate about, like, hey, look, you can clean the fingerprints off. You can clean the dust off. I mean, it gets a stone chip. Oh, well. Fix it. It'll work.
It's a piece of machinery.
Yeah.
Should be exercised.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, given that I think in reality, fewer people race than maybe they would have some of these cars, you know, they do track days or they'll do some time trial-y things if they're really into track driving, but like wheel to wheel racing is really serious. And if you talk to the, you know, people who run those organizations, yes, fewer by percentage of their members are actually racing wheel to wheel, but it's fun to just go out there and, you know, drive a car in a spirited way through corners or, like I said, off-road or whatever it is.
Canyons.
It's fun.
Yeah. So you mentioned rallies. Did you just go on this rally with Jeremy?
No. That was a different one. We do have a rally coming up and starting on Sunday in Northern California called the California Melee, which is a 1,000-mile rally through, it moves around California, but it's a 34-year-old event, and it's always been kind of early, you know, kind of 50s, early 60s sports cars driving, you know, spirited,
sure,
legal speeds for the most part.
Get that on record.
Yeah, through the great roads of California, and, you know, just great people driving great cars. So looking forward to that.
That's cool. What are you taking?
Usually take a speedster.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so cool. I have a really unusual speedster now. I always dreamed of having a speedster. Mine is orange.
Oh, that's a good speedster car.
Yeah, and there were like a half a dozen orange speedsters ever, and mine was one of them. So what I love it is because out of a sea of silver and black and all of the great color white that Porsches came in, when you have this orange one, people wonder if it was an original color. And I'm like, yep, it is.
That's awesome. I think one of the most unique things about 911s and speedsters and all these kind of Porsches that were sitting around is that you could slap any obnoxious color on it and it looks so good and it accentuates the body lines really well no matter what color is on it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's kind of an underappreciated aspect of Porsche design that they were willing to do some bold colors, especially once they got into the 911s. And, you know, you think of some of the great 70s cars with, you know, just wild kind of grabber greens and orange and yellow.
Even the browns.
Awesome. Yeah.
The browns are like some of my favorite 70s 911 colors.
We had the only new Porsche my family ever had when I was growing up. My dad got a really good deal on a 1976 912E, which was, you know, kind of the one short era 912 was a four-cylinder car.
E was electronically injected?
Yeah, it was in, okay. Well, the 912E, yes, that's exactly. So fuel injected, Einspritz, which is what's German for fuel injection. But what we didn't quite realize, my dad was colorblind, like completely colorblind. And I'll never forget, I'm sitting there at, like, after school, and my dad comes in, you know, my mom's name was Louise. Louise, you will not believe the deal I got in this car. We walk out, and it is, at the time, it was like the worst yellow you've ever seen. Like, not a good yellow. Kind of like this weird orangey yellow. And then it had dark orange interior with kind of like the plaid door panels.
That's like a McDonald's car.
And at the time, it looked terrible. And my mom and I are just like stunned. Like, do we tell him it's a really bad color? Because he's so proud of the deal he made on it. And it ended up just kind of becoming a family car. And now that color is probably really cool and rare and whatever. But, you know, back then it was just kind of ugly.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I also appreciate how Porsche took swings with the interior, too. Like the Pasha interior, the tartan, all that kind of stuff. Before, it was really commonplace.
Yes.
For nowadays, you know, you can get a Rolls-Royce or a Bentley in any spec, whatever color you want, whatever interior. And I think they were on the forefront of that.
They were, which is, you know, strange because, you know, there are stereotypes about German car companies being kind of stodgy,
conservative,
or, you know, engineering focused. And yet I think they always had a real sense of style, and it came out in that era especially. And when you look fast forward to, like, say, Singer or some of the, you know, modern more interpretations, I think they just built on that aspect of it. I mean, I love, you know, the Singers I've seen, like some of the coolest colors ever, and almost like they took Porsche and just turned it up a notch.
Yep. Yeah, I really love the remastering trend, even though I would never be able to afford anything like that.
That's a great term. I love that.
I think Gunther Works calls their cars remastered.
Ah, that's good.
But they find a really good balance of, like, luxury materials, but also, like, the visible screws and the diamond plate, whatever it is. It makes it look like a machine still, where it's not, like, unscratchable. Like, you can take it out and you can still drive. It's very spirited and it's meant to do that kind of stuff, but also it's very comfortable.
Yes.
In you know, maybe not a suspension.
Yeah, it's a little hard.
A little hard. But there are the very nice buttery leathers from the Elmo leathers or whatever.
And they celebrate the mechanical aspects. Yes. Like, you look at the engine compartments in those and they're just beautiful. And the components are visible, exposed, whereas I remember a few years back I got a new 911, and I remember the first thing I had to do was go, you know, open the engine compartment to see what it looked like, and there's another hood under there, which basically is the signal for don't look under here, there's nothing for you. You're not supposed to
bring it into a technician,
you don't get to see anything.
The Gunther Works makes it very exposed.
Yes,
I think the only Porsche I've ever driven is the Gunther Works, the, like, California Forest Service green one.
Oh, awesome.
It was amazing, and I was looking at, you know, like, put it into first, took off, and was looking at generational debt if I had crashed this thing. So.
Oh, yeah.
So you had mentioned before that you were kind of a punk as a teenager.
Yes.
Growing up in the Midwest as a punk in Milwaukee, can relate, and seeing your first car was like a shell, basically. I very heavily relate to that sentiment. What were your favorite bands in the 80s?
Well, I started playing guitar when I was 11, and it was the 80s, so, you know, this was kind of metal era, and I was Van Halen fan. So thoroughly crazed I was just obsessed over every single thing that Van Halen produced. And Van Halen, of course, Southern California, and it was kind of fun. It was hard rock, but it was like fun, party, good time, hard rock. Yeah. And I kind of just love that, to the point of decided to go to Southern California to college. So I went to Pepperdine.
Oh, cool.
And lived right down the road from Eddie. And, and he used to do these quiet little open mic nights at a bar in Malibu called the Trancas Bar and Grill. And so for me, I was just in heaven, because before he'd get ready to tour, he'd, like, work out on our campus at Pepperdine, So I just sit down there and obsessively watch
him. That's amazing.
And then go watch him play. And, you know, to me, that was that. And then I moved on to, you know, I saw Guns N' Roses play about a dozen times around Southern California, even before they were popular. Yeah. But then it was the Chili Peppers. And the Chili Peppers were kind of this just wild live act.
Yeah.
Back
Super
before
funky
they were
in their early days.
Funky, funky. And yeah. So I remember the early, you know, Hillel, the first guitarist for the Chili Peppers, and, you know, seeing them at Cal State Northridge and the, like, field house. I loved music in Southern California. And for me, that cars and music and guitars, and it just kind of all went together.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's a good era, too, like the Viper Room before it really died down.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw the Chili Peppers at the Whiskey.
Oh, wow.
And that was cool. That was cool. It's I feel lucky to be alive.
Yeah, that's a really cool experience. Yep. I have expected you to be like, and then my 9/11 broke down on the one, and then Eddie Van Halen popped out of nowhere and helped me pop start it. You know, like.
Well, I will tell you, my dad would not let me bring the 9/11 to college. And it was really weird because my dad and I were just, we had this really cool relationship, and there's no way I was going to bring a Ford truck out there.
Yeah.
So my parents made me live in Southern California for 2 years without a car. They just said, well, just figure it out, which is awful, right? It's just
terrible.
For
Pepperdine, that's pretty
brutal.
You have to drive everywhere.
Yeah, you literally cannot walk off the campus. And so I got really good grades, you know, and finally, like, I got 2 straight years of a 4.0. I'm like, you think I can get a car out here?
Yeah, please.
And they were pretty pleased with my GPA. So we kind of went back to my Michigan, the Ford roots. And I got a Mustang GT, a 5-liter.
Nice.
And that was my kind of baby in college.
Was it a Fox body?
It was. Well, yes. And it was the one with the, you know, kind of skirts around the so GT convertible had, the better skirts. And it was cool. It was manual, 5-speed. I went through 3 sets of tires in the first year had it. Well, you have Mulholland Drive there. So I would just, weekend, just rip the thing through there.
I was going to say, Pepperdine has that really big hill, the driveway.
Yes.
I was like, I couldn't imagine driving an underpowered car up to your dorm or something, like just stalling out on that huge hill.
Yeah. All my roommates had Hondas. I had the Mustang. It was pretty good.
That's fun. Yeah, I bet your neighbors loved you guys.
Oh, yeah. No, we had fun. Yeah. Loud music, cars, the whole thing. Yeah, me playing the guitar.
Fast forwarding to nowadays right now with all the tariffs happening.
We don't want to talk
about
this. Yeah, sorry. Okay.
You don't want to talk about it.
No, I'm kidding. We must. We must.
How, as a collector, someone maybe you import stuff, how are you navigating this new set of tariffs coming in?
It's going to be challenging. And, you know, we have a lot of partners who are the big car companies now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I worry about them because, you know, we've benefited so much in the car world from free trade and great car manufacturers bringing things in and us being able to buy them in affordable ways. So it's going to be, I mean, as long as these are in place at a high level, it's just going to make cool cars more expensive, unfortunately. Now, vintage cars right now, 25 years and older, are exempted.
That's what we thought.
Yes.
But then we got a screenshot of an importer. Our friend sent us one. I think they were importing like a Skyline from, it was a 99 Skyline R34, and they got slapped with a 37% tariff. And I was like, I think the muddiness of it is like, no one can really put their finger on what exactly is happening, but we were under the impression that anything 25 years or older was exempt from it. And now I'm seeing this kind of thing. I don't know if it's been deleted or it's been, I don't know if you can like take tariffs back or something, but.
Well, presumably they can roll back, but I mean, the latest we had was that 25 years are exempted. That would be new. And that number, that 30 something, is a number I had not heard of.
Cause I had heard it was 25% too.
Right. Yeah. 25%, which is 10X. Cause there was always a duty on cars. So at 2.5%, that was just sort of an expected amount. But 25% has been, you know, like people are freaking out about it. And so you think of like cars that are behind us, or you think of buying a new roof or something like that, you know, a $2 million car, like you're adding a big price to it. And that's a really unobtainable car, but it will add cost to a lot of things. And, you know, for people who are into aftermarket stuff, parts are not going to be exempt. Like it's just going to make everything. And so, you know, I just hope there's some pause or relief or something. But right now, it is not a pretty picture.
Yeah, I think eventually it'll get smoothed over, but there, it is just kind of like this political chess game going on right now. Hopefully it gets sorted out before it comes down to the consumer.
Your guess is as good as mine, but it's not great. And so you think of your listeners here. I think of, like, say, the popularity of the BMW brand, and you know, there's just been so many great enthusiast quality BMWs built. And granted, they built plenty of them. There are lots of them here. May actually drive the values of some of the vintage ones up, but it's just going to be more difficult out of a brand like that to get a 3 Series or whatever.
I think it's just overall used cars, new cars, everything is just growing and at kind of an uncomfortable rate. And yes. We're just in the infancy of it right now.
Well, and you add potentially high interest rates for newer cars. You know, most cars are financed.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a double hit.
The average monthly payment right now is like $800 for a brand new car financed, which is like, how much more can people afford? On that note, I don't know if you saw the news of Slate, the new EV truck company that is supposedly with government incentives offering EV trucks for $20,000 or less. All U.S. built. I don't know how much of that. Obviously, like, the battery components have to be imported.
It's pretty wild. I mean, the story, I've only read about them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what's interesting is what a stripped down, you know, kind of basic vehicle it is to be able to achieve that low price point.
Yeah.
You know, presumably a lot of, you know, smart modern manufacturing techniques to get there. And, you know, if you kind of look at the global automotive market and you look at, say, BYD in particular, I mean, they're just building epic electric vehicles for an inexpensive price point.
Leagues ahead of us.
Leagues, and in many ways, and they've got, you know, access to the supply chain. So for an American manufacturer to attempt this, I think is great. You know, my view of electric vehicles from the beginning has been that, like, I do not treat this like some religious war. It's not worth it. They're here. They're going to be a part of transportation. You know, as battery technology comes along and charging infrastructure comes along, they will be more and more viable. I have a Taycan. Which is just wickedly fast, a little heavy, wickedly fast, but I think we're just going to see them. I also think we're going to see internal combustion cars for a long, long time.
I think so too.
And so I'm here to comment.
Sure.
Not to take a position that's positive or negative, you know?
As like someone who reads comments all the time on YouTube and Instagram, I think it's weird to be so staunchly ICE or so staunchly EV. Like, there's the middle ground is great. Yeah. You know, hybrids are great right now. It's weird to just, like, pick a side.
Yeah, I mean, truly. I mean, step back, you know, from just the weirdness of all of that. If you were, like, really in, I mean, just like you, the environment was everything that you live for and you needed a new car, a plug-in hybrid is a really great way to go. Put a solar panel on your house, charge it up. You're not going to use a lot of gas for the whole year. You can drive around town in all electric mode. There's some really good ones and they're pretty affordable. That would be the way to go.
Yeah.
Complicated cars, lots of components, lots of stuff to maybe be a problem over time.
Probably expensive to fix.
Right. Yeah. But when I think of EVs, I think there'll be some sort of bright future for them. And I think there'll be hopefully a bright future for internal combustion cars. I think, you know, full credit to some of the most amazing advances in technology for internal combustion cars. More power, fewer cylinders.
Super efficient.
Think of the amazing transmissions that have been developed in the last decade, you know, 7-speed, 8-speed, 9-speed. And, like, they're just making great performance internal combustion cars that are more efficient, super, I mean, just awesome in my view. So it's just a big world. I kind of like them all, or I find value in all of them.
Yeah.
So why, I don't understand the vitriol.
That's a great point of view to take into it. I think we are running out of time right now. But
what should we hit?
Last thing I want to ask you, we are at this amazing Porsche auction right now. Is there anything in this room that you're super excited about and you might bid on?
Oh, it's dangerous for me to bid at auctions. So I tend to sit on my hands at these things because I have bought cars at auctions, but I really do the research. That was my recommendation. If you're going to buy a car at auction, do your research. And if you're not sure, bring a friend who really knows, because, you know, you can buy, it's, It's difficult, and especially when you get excited around the bidding. The cool thing about this is the second year running these, an all Porsche auction is a cool thing because I don't think there's been a single car on the rise more than Porsches. It's a big enough world that will support an all Porsche auction. So you see great 356s. There's some great 911s here, 918, Carrera GTs. Of course, I think the bell of the ball will be the Yellowbird roof. You know,
I didn't even see that.
There's a real Yellowbird here.
What number is it?
Lot number, I'm not sure, but you know, my guess is, I mean, that'll be a $4 or $5 million car.
Jeez, that's crazy. I was talking about like, because I've seen.
Oh, do you need me to get you a bidder's paddle? No. We can get you. You said you want it. You want
a new
car.
Gonna kill me. Yeah. I bought a Yellowbird.
And that's it. That's all we'll ever have. Yeah, that's an expensive car. But even to see a Yellowbird is rare stuff.
It's super rare, and I'm sure probably one of the only times for most of the people in this room to see a genuine Yellowbird.
Yes.
I didn't take myself as a speedster fan, but there's some amazing speedsters in this room. The Zagato 356 in the corner is amazing. This X88 or X86 or something, the 94 yellow one.
Yeah, yeah.
One of like 84 different versions of it. 94 Turbo is amazing. I just wish I'd brought my wallet. I'm going to have to borrow Audrey's wallet if I'm going to bid.
Well, there's one Porsche that left the family years ago. When my dad got into Porsches, he kind of went crazy with them. And when I was in college, he bought a gray market 76 Turbo. And that was when they were actually called a 911 Turbo before they were kind of the 930s.
What market did it come from?
It was a German car.
Okay.
And it was originally painted pink with chartreuse interior.
What?
When we got it, it had been painted dark green.
Oh, no.
But it was just kind of the family turbo. And now, of course, those early turbos are just, you know, rarer than hen's teeth.
Yeah.
And I so wish that had not left the fold. But,
oh, no.
You know, someday I'll find another one.
But you still have the original car that you helped build.
My 911, yes.
That's amazing. That's such a cool story, and I hope you hold on to it forever.
Oh, yeah. No, that one will. Yeah, I tell my kids, like, hey, be sure, whenever my funeral is, I hope it's a long time in the future, drive that in the funeral procession. Somebody has to, because it'll be with me forever. The sad thing, though, is when people say, well, what's your favorite car? And I'm like, well, my favorite car will always be my 911. But, you know, the real question is, what's my second favorite car?
Yeah.
And that's whatever is next. You know, whatever the next one is. So
yeah, you buy.
Yeah, whatever you buy next, and you get excited about it. And I like all sorts of cars. So anyway, thanks for what you're doing. This is awesome.
Dude, thank you so much for having us. And thank you for the tickets to Motorlux last year. If there's anything that you want to plug right now, now's the time to do it.
Well, it's pretty exciting to be here at this Broad Arrow auction. They're doing a great job. You know, I think kind of setting a new standard for how auctions can run. We do fun cars like this, like the Porsche auction. And you mentioned Motorlux, you know, they'll be doing a big auction there. And our very first European sale is coming up in May.
Wow.
At the Villa d'Este Concours on Lake Como, which will be, I guess, Aperol spritzes all around or whatever it is they have on Lake Como. I'm not really sure, but it'll be really fun to see their work.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, we're just, despite all the challenges of things like tariffs and different things going on, wildfires in LA, we're just still really bullish on the car world, and I'm so excited that the next generation of people are interested and rising up and buying cool cars. So we'll be here for you.
That's awesome. That's really cool to see your enthusiasm come out. And I'm going to go check out this auction. So
let's go get you a bidder's paddle.
Yeah,
first of all, we got to go get you a bidder's paddle. We're going to spend all your money. Yeah, it'll be awesome.
I can't wait.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Cool. See you back in the studio. That was my interview with McKeel. I feel very privileged to be able to talk to him about this kind of stuff. And, you know, he's not just like this CEO dude. He fixed his car up, fixed a $500 Porsche up in the 80s and got it running. And that's his most prized possession.
Still has it.
Still has it. Cool. It's like awesome. And he's never going to sell it. So
cool.
That's really cool.
Well, good job, Joe. That is our show for this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Give us a like and a follow if you haven't already, if you feel like doing that. It means a lot. Or a review on the podcast platform of your choice. We do check those out. And
there's no reason why you can't do both of those.
Well, don't pressure them.
Do it.
Go check out our other podcast, Past Gas. It's a history show. This week, we're talking about Max Arido, a legendary Japanese driver really stoked to have covered that guy. Jimmy's on that episode, is he not?
This is a really good episode. Jimmy just goes crazy.
Jimmy goes crazy. If you want to hear Jimmy go crazy, check this episode out. I love doing Past Gas, and we're having fun with it. It's a good time. So if you never listen to Past Gas, check that out. Follow us at Donut Podcasts on Instagram and our personal accounts. You can follow Bart at Bids Bardo. He can teach you about the pick and roll. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thank you to our crew. We've got Mark, Audrey, and Edgar behind the camera there. Right behind you. Right over there. Right behind you. The other side. I promise you. And we will see you next time.
Bye.